spirit had been distorted by the circumstances of my life. He laughed and threatened to cover my head with dirt if I kept on talking in that vein. He said that I was a man, and like any man, I deserved everything that was a man's lot: joy, pain, sadness, and struggle, and that the nature of one's acts was unimportant as long as one acted as a warrior. Lowering his voice to almost a whisper, he said that if I really felt that my spirit was distorted, I should simply fix it, purge it, make it perfect, because there was no other task in our entire lives which was more worthwhile. Not to fix the spirit was to seek death, and that was the same as to seek nothing, since death was going to overtake us regardless of anything. He paused for a long time, and then he said with a tone of profound conviction, "To seek the perfection of the warrior spirit is the only task worthy of our manhood." His words acted as a catalyst. I felt the weight of my past actions as an unbearable and hindering load. I admitted that there was no hope for me. I began to weep, talking about my life. I said that I had been roaming for such a long time that I'd become callous to pain and sadness, except on certain occasions when I would realize my aloneness and my helplessness. He didn't say anything. He grabbed me by the armpits and pulled me out of the cage. I sat up when he let go of me. He also sat down. An uneasy silence set in between us. I thought he was giving me time to compose myself. I took my notebook and scribbled out of nervousness. "You feel like a leaf at the mercy of the wind, don't you?" he finally said, staring at me. That was exactly the way I felt. He seemed to empathize with me. He said that my mood reminded him of a song, and began to sing in a low tone. His singing voice was very pleasing, and the lyrics carried me away. "I'm so far away from the sky where I was born. Immense nostalgia invades my thoughts. Now that I'm so alone and sad like a leaf in the wind, sometimes I want to weep, sometimes I want to laugh with longing. Qué lejos estoy del cielo donde he nacido. Inmensa nostalgia invade mi pensamiento. Ahora que estoy tan solo y triste, cual hoja al viento, quisiera llorar, quisiera reír de sentimiento." We didn't speak for a long while. He finally broke the silence. "Since the day you were born, one way or another, someone has been doing something to you," he said. "That's correct," I said. "And they've been doing something to you against your will." "True. And by now, you're helpless, like a leaf in the wind." "That's correct. That's the way it is." I said that the circumstances of my life had sometimes been devastating. He listened attentively, but I couldn't figure out whether he was just being agreeable or genuinely concerned until I noticed that he was trying to hide a smile. "No matter how much you like to feel sorry for yourself, you have to change that," he said in a soft tone. "It doesn't jibe with the life of a warrior." He laughed and sang the song again, but contorted the intonation of certain words. The result was a ludicrous lament. He pointed out that the reason I'd liked the song was because in my own life I had done nothing else but find flaws with everything and lament. I couldn't argue with him. He was correct. Yet I believed I had sufficient reasons to justify my feeling of being like a leaf in the wind. "The hardest thing in the world is to assume the mood of a warrior," he said. "It's of no use to be sad and complain and feel justified in doing so, believing that someone is always doing something to us. Nobody is doing anything to anybody, much less to a warrior. You are here with me because you want to be here. You should have assumed full responsibility by now, so the idea that you're at the mercy of the wind would be inadmissible." He stood up and began to disassemble the cage. He scooped the dirt back to where he had gotten it from and carefully scattered all the sticks in the chaparral. Then he covered the clean circle with debris, leaving the area as if nothing had ever touched it. I commented on his proficiency. He said that a good hunter would know that we'd been there no matter how careful he had been, because the tracks of men could not be completely erased. He sat cross-legged and told me to sit down as comfortably as possible, facing the spot where he had buried me, and stay put until my mood of sadness had dissipated. A warrior buries himself in order to find power, not to weep with self-pity, he said. I attempted to explain, but he made me stop with an impatient movement of his head. He said that he had to pull me out of the cage in a hurry, because my mood was intolerable, and he was afraid that the place would resent my softness and injure me. Self-pity doesn't jibe with power, he said. The mood of a warrior calls for control over himself, and at the same time, it calls for abandoning himself. How can that be? I asked. How can he control and abandon himself at the same time? It is a difficult technique, he said. He seemed to deliberate whether or not to continue talking. Twice he was on the verge of saying something, but he checked himself and smiled. You're not over your sadness yet, he said. You still feel weak, and there's no point in talking about the mood of a warrior now. Almost an hour went by in complete silence. Then he abruptly asked me if I had succeeded in learning the dreaming techniques he had taught me. I had been practicing assiduously, and had been able, after a monumental effort, to obtain a degree of control over my dreams. Don Juan was very right in saying that one could interpret the exercises as being entertainment. For the first time in my life, I'd been looking forward to going to sleep. I gave him a detailed report of my progress. It had been relatively easy for me to learn to sustain the image of my hands after I had learned to command myself to look at them. My visions, although not always of my own hands, would last a seemingly long time until I would finally lose control and would become immersed in ordinary, unpredictable dreams. I had no volition whatsoever over when I would give myself the command to look at my hands or to look at other items of the dreams. It would just happen. At any given moment, I would remember that I had to look at my hands, and then at the surroundings. There were nights, however, when I couldn't recall having done it at all. He seemed to be satisfied, and wanted to know what were the usual items I'd been finding in my visions. I couldn't think of anything in particular, and started elaborating on a nightmarish dream I had had the night before. "Don't get so fancy," he said dryly. I told him that I had been recording all the details of my dreams. Since I'd begun to practice looking at my hands, my dreams had become very compelling, and my sense of recall had increased to the point that I could remember minute details. He said that to follow them was a waste of time, because details and vividness were in no way important. "Ordinary dreams get very vivid as soon as you begin to set up dreaming," he said. "That vividness and clarity is a formidable barrier, and you are worse off than anyone I've ever met in my life. You have the worst mania. You write down everything you can." In all fairness, I believed what I was doing was appropriate. Keeping a meticulous record of my dreams was giving me a degree of clarity about the nature of the visions I had while sleeping. "Drop it," he said imperatively. "It's not helping anything. All you're doing is distracting yourself from the purpose of dreaming, which is control and power." He lay down and covered his eyes with his hat and talked without looking at me. "I'm going to remind you of all the techniques you must practice," he said. "First, you must focus your gaze on your hands as the starting point. Then, shift your gaze to other items and look at them in brief glances. Focus your gaze on as many things as you can. Remember that if you only glance briefly, the images don't shift. Then, go back to your hands. Every time you look at your hands, you renew the power needed for dreaming, So in the beginning, don't look at too many things. 4 items will suffice every time. Later on, you may enlarge the scope until you can cover all you want. But as soon as the images begin to shift and you feel you're losing control, go back to your hands. When you feel you can gaze at things indefinitely, you'll be ready for a new technique. I'm going to teach you this new technique now, but I expect you to put it to use only when you're ready. He was quiet for about 15 minutes. Finally, he sat up and looked at me. The next step in setting up dreaming is to learn to travel, he said. The same way you've learned to look at your hands, you can will yourself to move, to go places. First, you have to establish a place you want to go to. Pick a well-known spot, perhaps your school or a park, a friend's house. Then, will yourself to go there. This technique is very difficult. You must perform 2 tasks. You must will yourself to go to the specific locale. And then, when you have mastered that technique, you have to learn to control the exact time of your traveling. As I wrote down his statements, I had the feeling that I was really nuts. I was actually taking down insane instructions, knocking myself out in order to follow them. I experienced a surge of remorse and embarrassment. "What are you doing to me, Don Juan?" I asked, not really meaning it. He seemed surprised. He stared at me for an instant and then smiled. "You've been asking me the same question over and over. I'm not doing anything to you. You are making yourself accessible to power. You're hunting it, and I'm just guiding you." He tilted his head to the side and studied me. He held my chin with one hand and the back of my head with the other, and then moved my head back and forth. The muscles of my neck were very tense, and moving my head reduced the tension. Don Juan looked up to the sky for a moment and seemed to examine something in it. "It's time to leave," he said dryly, and stood up. We walked in an easterly direction until we came upon a patch of small trees in a valley between 2 large hills. It was almost 5 p.m. by then. He casually said that we might have to spend the night in that place. He pointed to the trees and said that there was water around there. He tensed his body and began sniffing the air like an animal. I could see the muscles of his stomach contracting in very fast, short spasms as he blew and inhaled through his nose in rapid succession. He urged me to do the same and find out by myself where the water was. I reluctantly tried to imitate him. After 5 or 6 minutes of fast breathing, I was dizzy, but my nostrils had cleared out in an extraordinary way, and I could actually detect the smell of river willows. I couldn't tell where they were, however. Don Juan told me to rest for a few minutes, and then he started me sniffing again. The second round was more intense. I could actually distinguish a whiff of river willow coming from my right. We headed in that direction and found, a good quarter of a mile away, a swamp-like spot with stagnant water. We walked around it to a slightly higher, flat mesa. Above and around the mesa, the chaparral was very thick. "This place is crawling with mountain lions and other smaller cats," Don Juan said casually, as if it were a commonplace observation. I ran to his side, and he broke out laughing. "Usually I wouldn't come here at all," he said. "But the crow pointed out this direction. There must be something special about it." "Do we really have to be here, Don Juan?" "We do. Otherwise I would avoid this place." I'd become extremely nervous. He told me to listen attentively to what he had to say. "The only thing one can do in this place is hunt lions," he said. "So, I'm going to teach you how to do that. There's a special way of constructing a trap for water rats that live around water holes. They serve as bait. The sides of the cage are made to collapse, and very sharp spikes are put along the sides. The spikes are hidden when the trap is up, and they don't affect anything, unless something falls on the cage, in which case the sides collapse, and the spikes pierce whatever hits the trap." I couldn't understand what he meant, but he made a diagram on the ground and showed me that if the side sticks of the cage were placed on pivot-like hollow spots on the frame,